waters too. With stomach nodding slowness, the fishing boat lumbered past the halfway point to Gibraltar. There were just a few miles left, but the boat was getting there at a near crawl. The Spanish scout planes peeled away, not willing to risk being mistaken for Germans by RAF Spitfires or Hurricane fighter planes. British patrol boats now appeared ahead of the fishing vessel. From the flagpoles at their sterns, the Union Jack snapped in the gusts. As comforting as the sight was, Arthur and Cleaver were still not safe. A U-boat could have them in the crosshairs of a periscope a mile or more away. Also, the Royal Navy had heavily mined the waters around Gibraltar from past fears of German or even Spanish assaults. Like all of the Spanish skippers sneaking Allied escapees to the Rock, the seaman ferrying Arthur and Cleaver knew the safe passages among the minefields. Allied agents provided the captains with secret charts of the routes, and after the skippers memorized them, the charts were destroyed to prevent them from falling into the hands of collaborators or the Nazis. Suddenly, the Rock of Gibraltar loomed right in front of and above Arthur. 1,398 feet of stark cliffs that commanded the path between the Atlantic and the Mediterranean. One half of the ancient Greeks and Romans' mythic Pillars of Hercules. The fishing boat slowed even more as it neared several long steel piers, where more patrol boats and several Royal Navy frigates and destroyers were moored. A town that appeared completely deserted stretched from the harbor to the foot of the mountain. The town was, in fact, deserted. When the war had broken out, the British government had evacuated Gibraltar's civilian population, mainly to London and also Morocco, Madeira, and Jamaica. Now, with complete Allied control of the skies above Gibraltar, the Royal Navy no longer had to worry about Luftwaffe strikes against the port. The biggest threat rested with the U-boats. While there was little question that a German submarine had spotted the fishing boat at some point of the trip, and may well have been tipped off that a high-priority British escapee was on the vessel, the skipper would not have risked a torpedo attack that would have revealed his location with so much daylight left. The boat throttled down and eased against one of the piers with a gentle thud. As crewmen lowered the gangplank, a jeep rattled onto the dock and alongside the vessel. Two officers stepped out of the jeep, boarded, walked straight up to Arthur and Cleaver, and asked for their identification from the Barcelona consulate. One wore the olive-drab uniform of the U.S. Army, the other of the tan-hued issue of the Royal Army. After checking the photos and papers, one of the officers gave the escapees the customary greeting. "Gentlemen, welcome back to the war." Chapter 30. It is therefore secret. As Arthur and Cleaver settled into the back seat of the jeep, the fishing boat pulled away from the pier and churned back out into the channel. The jeep surged forward, and Arthur and Cleaver hung on as it shot toward an opening at the base of the rock. Seconds later, they were moving up the mountain through a labyrinth of illuminated tunnels. Other jeeps moved through the tunnels, the American and British uniforms everywhere emphasizing the fact that Arthur's and Cleaver's long months on the run were truly ending. A giant clock affixed to a bone-white limestone wall read 1 p.m. Inside the Rock of Gibraltar, miles of limestone had been blasted to create a vast underground city, with huge man-made caverns, barracks, offices, and a fully equipped hospital. About 30,000 British and American soldiers dwelled within the complex. The government of Gibraltar's records for the Great Siege Tunnels state, "This town inside the rock contained its own power station and water supply. Some soldiers posted here would not see the light of day for months on end. Engineer companies with diamond-tipped drills added some 30 miles of such tunnels, a feat thought impossible at the time." At the foot of the mountain's northern walls, the engineers had carved out an aerodrome where Arthur and Cleaver were to be put on transport planes bound for London. First, though, an arduous debriefing and interrogation and a round of paperwork to complete awaited both men. After an examination at the hospital, they were issued uniforms, shoes, and watches, and were fed a hot meal in a massive mess hall, with cups of the first real coffee either man had tasted in months. And a clerk showed up to escort Arthur to the military liaison office of the American consulate. Someone would arrive shortly to take Cleaver to the RAF debriefing office. The American and the Englishman understood that the time had come for them to part ways and return to their squadrons. Well aware that they would likely not see each other again, they stood and shook hands. No words were necessary. Later, with emotions simmering beneath understated words, Cleaver wrote, "I would add that without Taillandier and Meyerowitz in particular, I would never have reached safety. Of their valor and friendship, I can hardly begin to render fitting words." As Arthur followed the clerk to the limestone-walled office of Colonel Horace W. Forster, the American liaison in Gibraltar, his thoughts turned to Esther, his parents, and his brother Seymour. He checked his new GI watch. It was just after 2:30 p.m. The airman wanted to know when he could get word to them that he was alive. Forster, after his initial conversation with Arthur, sent a cablegram to London. Dated June 16, 1944, the cable informed the commanding general, European Theater of Operations, U.S. Army, that the enlisted man named below, Staff Sergeant Arthur S. Meyerowitz, 448th Bomb Group, having reported to this station, will proceed by first available transportation to London, England, where he will report to the commanding general. The colonel allowed Arthur to write a few brief lines for a cable to his family, so long as he revealed nothing about his whereabouts or where he had been since December 31, 1943. Arthur was handed a detailed questionnaire in which he was required to recount the events aboard and loss of Harmful Lil Armful. All of his own actions on the mission, his parachute jump, and everything he could recall about the conduct of every member of the crew. He battled whether to reveal the loss of nerve and cowardly conduct of the pilot, Second Lieutenant Philip J. Chase. Having discussed Chase's actions with Cleaver, a man who did everything that a pilot was supposed to do, and had harshly criticized Chase's conduct as related by the B-24's flight engineer, Arthur wondered whether he should come clean about the skipper of Harmful Lil Armful. Not certain if Chase was even alive, but certain that Air Corps brass might not place much credence in the charges of an airman against an officer, Arthur held back. He filled out the questionnaire without criticizing Chase. It was a decision that would haunt him for the rest of his life. It would have been worse years later if he had ever seen Chase's classified account of Harmful Lil Armful's final flight, a retelling that stood in stark, self-serving contrast to everything Arthur knew about that mission. Required to write an account of his ordeal in France, Arthur related every moment from his painful landing in the trees to the journey to Gibraltar. He listed and described everyone who had helped him, the places he had stayed, 96 Boulevard Del Tour was the only actual address he knew, the escape route he had taken, and the ways in which he had evaded the Nazis and the police. Arthur was on a transport plane out of Gibraltar the next day, June 17th, and landed at Bristol, England that night. His back blazed with pain that would bedevil him for the rest of his life, and he was still suffering from frostbite. It was too early for him to start processing all that had happened from the inspection of Harmful Lil Armful on the airstrip at Seething on December 31, 1943, to the moment he had set foot on Gibraltar. Letting his guard down still seemed impossible at that moment, if ever. The constant fear of discovery and death was not something a person could shake overnight. He was far from doing that, but for the moment, the realization that he would see Esther and his family again pushed back all the other emotions with which he was grappling. Marcel Taillandier, Giselle, and all the men and women who had so gladly risked their lives for a stranger from the States would remain a part of him for the rest of his life. Safe now, he felt guilty that his French friends still lived in moment-to-moment danger. In Giselle's case, if she still lived at all. Arthur scarcely stepped from the plane at Bristol before he was led to the office of First Lieutenant Charles A. Byron, of the Adjutant General's office. Byron slid a pen and single-page, typed document, with the word restricted emblazoned across the top of the sheet. As Arthur studied the document, he realized that he would never be able to reveal the true story of how Philip Chase's decision to fly with a bum engine and to jump from the crippled B-24 before his crew had sealed the bomber's fate. He did understand the need to keep secret the names of the French men and women who had aided him. Some of them were likely doing the same for other downed pilots and airmen at that very moment. When he signed the document, he accepted the fact that the details of his escape or evasion from capture could be useful to the enemy and a danger to your friends. It is therefore secret. His signature proved he grasped and accepted the classified status of his debrief. You must therefore not disclose, 1, the names of those who helped you, 2, the method by which you escaped or evaded, 3, the route you followed, 4, any other facts concerning your experience. The Western Union cablegram Arthur had sent from Gibraltar the previous day had already reached New York. Chapter 31. Rockaway Beach. On Friday, June 16, 1944, Seymour Meyerowitz walked home to 1205 Finley Avenue from Robert Morris High School. A sultry sun washed across the Bronx as he neared the yellow brick apartment house. Each day that passed without any word from Arthur, Seymour prayed for his brother's safe return. However, he battled doubts that his prayers would be answered. Seymour marveled at their mother Rose's faith that Arthur was alive. She never lost her faith that God would bring him back, and she would not allow anyone else to question it in her presence. Arthur's girlfriend, Esther Lowe, was having perhaps the roughest time, as neither a letter from Arthur nor any word from the War Department arrived. The silence ripped at her and wore her down. As she grew more distraught, her family and the Meyerowitz family feared that she was teetering on the verge of an emotional breakdown. It was understandable, Seymour observed. She was deeply in love with my brother, he would later say. To try to cheer Esther up, the Lowes had rented a bungalow at Rockaway Beach and invited the Meyerowitz family to join them for a few days. Seymour was supposed to meet everyone at the cottage later in the day with his Uncle Max, who would drive. Seymour was glad to have an afternoon off from his after-school job assembling expensive fluorescent fixtures at a lamp factory. As he reached the building on Finley Avenue, ran up the front stairs to the entryway and stepped inside, all he knew about his older brother's fate was that Arthur was still listed as MIA, missing in action. Seymour had a task to perform for his mother. Before he left for school that morning, Rose instructed him to check for any telegrams from the War Department that might arrive during the day. Seymour did not expect to find one. Why should today be any different from all the others since the family had last received a communication from the Army? Still, a part of him feared that a message could come at any time, and he wondered how he would react. If grim news arrived, how could he tell his mother? What if today was the day? He could not and did not want to imagine life without his older brother. Even though Arthur was missing, no one could yet say he was gone. One thing Seymour could easily imagine was what would happen if he did not check for the telegram. "No place to hide if I didn't," he recalled. He climbed the three flights of stairs in the hot, sticky building and walked down the hall to 1205. He pushed his key into the lock, and as the latch clicked and the door swung open, he saw a telegram lying at his feet. A scream exploding from him, Seymour got kind of hysterical. From down the hall, Mrs. Baden, a neighbor, rushed from her apartment to see if he was all right. Shaking, terrified of the telegram's contents, 16-year-old Seymour stared down at the envelope. "I was afraid," he would remember. Several neighbors looked out their doors to find Seymour now standing rigid and looking down at the yellow piece of paper. The neighbors immediately understood. Mrs. Baden bent down, picked up the envelope, and opened it to find a Western Union cablegram. She asked Seymour if he wanted her to read it, and he nodded. She said, "It's from your brother." "I was stunned," Seymour would say. Mrs. Baden read the message, addressed to Mrs. Dave Meyerowitz, out loud. "Dear folks in Seymour, everything okay here. Hope to be seeing you all very soon. My love to everyone. Love, Artie Meyerowitz." His head swimming with a torrent of emotions, Seymour tried to focus on what to do next. It was not easy. His elation blurred his ability to reason for a few moments, and his eyes kept filling up. Then he calmed down. His first action was to get word to his mother and father and Esther at the beach, but it would take at least a couple of hours by bus or Uncle Max's car to join up with them. This news could not wait. "We needed a telephone line," Seymour said. The only person in the building who had one was a neighbor on the first floor, and he raced down the stairs and pounded on her door. When she opened it, he breathlessly explained to her that his brother was alive, and he needed to reach his parents immediately, but they were on the beach at Rockaway. Everyone with a serviceman overseas knew how important a moment like this was, and the neighbor dialed the operator, told her that we have a missing airman telegram, and put Seymour on the line. When he related that his parents were somewhere on the beach, the operator, who must have known her way around Rockaway, suggested calling a candy store close to the beach and see if anyone there might be able to go look for the family and Esther. She called the shop, and when a clerk who was there alone answered, she told the youth that she had an emergency. She needed his help to find the parents and sweetheart of an airman who had just turned up alive after being MIA for 6 months. Then she put Seymour on the phone. Without hesitation, the clerk agreed to help. He found a large piece of cardboard, scrawled a message in large letters, locked up the store without even considering lost business, and raced onto the beach with his sign. There, more than an hour later, a middle-aged couple and a pretty black-haired young woman rushed through the thick white sand toward him. Tears streamed down their sun-darkened faces. Rose, David, and Esther had spotted the words scribbled on the cardboard sign. "Mr. and Mrs. Meyerowitz, your son is alive." While the candy clerk was trying to find Rose, David, and Esther, Seymour thanked Mrs. Baden and the downstairs neighbor profusely. Now he needed to get out to Rockaway. He dashed back upstairs to lock the apartment and then ran back down and out the front door of the building. He sprinted several blocks to his Uncle Max's building and, his breaths coming in ragged gulps, half staggered to Max's door. When his uncle opened it, the sweating teenager blurted out, "Artie is safe. You need to get me to Rockaway." Max grabbed his car keys. When Seymour and Max pulled up to the Lowe's beach bungalow a few hours later, they waded into what Seymour called a sea of relatives. Everyone was crying, laughing, hugging, and kissing. The news that Artie was alive making the night emotional beyond belief. On June 29th, 1944, another Western Union message arrived at the door of the Meyerowitz family. The office of the adjutant general officially confirmed that Arthur was safe. "Am pleased to inform you your son, Staff Sergeant Arthur S. Meyerowitz, returned to duty 17th June. Undoubtedly, he will communicate with you at an early date concerning his welfare and whereabouts." Rose Meyerowitz had somehow known. She knew her son Arthur and believed that he would be just the one to beat the odds. Staff Sergeant Arthur S. Meyerowitz had beaten odds that neither Rose, his family, nor Esther could ever fully comprehend, and would never know the details of. Seymour would be the only one to learn the full extent of Arthur's ordeal, some 70 years later. Arthur should have been dead several times over, and he understood that. As with most veterans of the greatest generation, he grasped that he was one of the fortunate ones. He was coming home, but the war was coming back within him. In late July 1944, Arthur was sent to a hospital to recover from his injuries. His back was bad, Seymour said decades later. He could not do a lot physically. Typical of the men who returned from World War II, Arthur never complained or whined about anything. When he limped out of a New Jersey military hospital in late July 1944 and hailed a cab, he instructed the driver to take him to 1205 Finley Avenue. It would be the first time he had seen his family since a brief furlough in the early fall of 1943. He had the driver circle the apartment building 3 times before finally stepping from the cab. He was afraid that his mother was not all right because of her worry about him. The moment he knocked on the door and was swarmed by his parents, his brother, and Esther, his fears evaporated. Seymour caught a glimpse of just how much his older brother had suffered overseas, and just how much he wanted to talk about it, but could not yet do so. He had signed a pledge to secrecy until such time as the Army declassified his debrief and written accounts. Overhearing a late-night conversation between Arthur and his father, Seymour heard Arthur say that he wished he could get a pistol and kill both pilots. "Dad," Arthur related, "they were the first 2 guys out of the plane." There were also the nightmares. Arthur slept fitfully. The faces of McNamara and Dunham, Giselle and Pierre, Taillandier, Cleaver, and all the others always with him. Although his cablegram home had assured his family everything okay here, the memories he brought back with him were never to be fully okay. Arthur Meyerowitz had indeed come home, but part of him remained in France, and always would. Epilogue. Awarded the Purple Heart for the severe back injury he suffered on his parachute jump into France, Arthur S. Meyerowitz spent nearly a year in various military hospitals. He longed to rejoin the 715th Bomber Squadron, but the Army Air Corps did not allow men to return to combat if they had been shot down and managed to escape from the enemy. Even without that policy, military doctors would have deemed Arthur's injuries too severe for a return to combat. He was offered administrative jobs if he opted to remain in the Army Air Corps as a career, his superiors recognizing his courage, his initiative, his toughness, and his intelligence. Few airmen or pilots could have fooled the Gestapo, the police, and collaborators in Vichy, France into believing that Georges Lambert was the deaf-mute he claimed to be. Arthur was awarded the Purple Heart and promoted to tech sergeant. Even if he had wanted to remain in the military, he knew he could not put his mother and Esther through such an ordeal again. He was honorably discharged in the fall of 1945, and that same year he married Esther Lowe. They raised a family, a daughter, Carol, and a son, Mark. Letters from Arthur's French friends began to arrive in 1945 after the liberation of the nation and the final defeat of the Nazis. In all likelihood, Arthur learned of the death of Taillandier from Madame Rigal and Mademoiselle Toulouse. On December 16, 1945, Madame Rigal wrote, "Well, darling, the man who has done so much for you, who was called Marcel Taillandier and was really the Commandant Morange, has been killed by the German Gestapo. It has been a terrible loss for us. He was killed near Toulouse." Mademoiselle Toulouse wrote on March 28, 1945, "Taillandier died, and Leo and Jeannot cleaned, killed, by the Gestapo. This is unfortunate, and the death of Taillandier did great harm to our entire team, which is now almost completely disorganized." The news of Taillandier's death undoubtedly had a profound impact on Arthur. He corresponded with his French friends throughout 1945 and 1946, and the letters that he received, as well as one Madame Rigal sent to Rose Meyerowitz, brimmed with love, respect, and admiration for the airman. On January 21, 1945, Madame Rigal wrote to Rose from Beaumont de Lomagne, "Arthur is such a nice young man. I considered him as my son. Poor dear, we were obliged to hide him, and I did my best so he could have the most comfort we could offer him. It has been a great trial for him, but he was so courageous and a real soldier. I admired him so much, you must be so proud." Charlotte Michel from L'Espar wrote on May 5, 1945, "My dear Arthur, I have just received your letter written on the 27th of March. Arthur, do you remember your departure from Bordeaux to Moissac? With all the police around you? It was cold, but you were very hot. And the crossing of demarcation line? The control of the identity cards by the police captain? So you remember Monsieur Georges Lambert? We speak very often of those things. We hope to see you again in France one day. All your friends would be happy to see you paying a visit to them." Charlotte was delighted to hear of Arthur's engagement to Esther, writing on June 3, 1945, "We have heard of your engagement with a real pleasure. We wish you to be very happy, and all your friends from France are sending you their best wishes. With our wishes, I am sending, too, a little gift for your fiancé and yourself. I should have liked to send you a case of old wines, but we are not allowed to do it now. I wonder when all those things are going to go normally again." In a July 17, 1945 postcard from teenage Christian Michel, the deep bond between Arthur and all the friends who helped him escape from France was apparent. "Dear Arthur, now I must tell you that from all the parachuters we had at L'Espar, you are the only one to send us news. So, please go on in being charming and do write to us. We are waiting for a long letter, soon followed by your arrival in France." Sadly, Arthur never returned to France, as the demands of his own life and family took center stage, and the post-war years passed, the correspondence between New York and France dwindled and eventually stopped. Perhaps the death of Taillandier weighed so heavily on Arthur that the thought of visiting was simply too painful. In January 1945, he had requested that the army return the small gun, which is a very highly prized possession of mine. It was the pistol that Taillandier had given him in the Maquis. "If you, Captain Dorothy Smith, an administrative officer, WAC, Women's Army Corps, can send it to me, it would be very much appreciated. And if not, would you tell me how I could go about claiming it in the near future? As you no doubt remember, it holds very fond memories, and I would like to have it when the war is all over, so that I can look back upon those days when it came in handy." Captain Smith replied on March 13, 1945, "We can't send a gun through the mail. We don't know how or when it will get to you, but don't worry about it because we fully appreciate your attachment to it." The Meyerowitz family does not know if Arthur's pistol from Taillandier was ever returned. Along with the crushing reports of Taillandier's death, Arthur was certainly affected by the disturbing news in the spring of 1945 about Gisèle Chauvin. Arthur's Bordeaux friend and helper, Robert J. Ardichin, and Charlotte Michel told Arthur that Gisèle had not yet come home to her family. Ardichin wrote, "Mrs. Chauvin of L'Espard has also been deported, sent to a concentration camp, in June 1944. Charlotte Michel informed Arthur that Mrs. Chauvin, Dr. Chauvin's wife, was arrested by the Gestapo 1 year ago and deported in Germany. Nobody heard from her since. Rose Meyerowitz passed away in September 1962, and David almost a year later in August 1963. They knew how fortunate they were that their son Arthur had defied the longest of odds to come back to them. Seymour Meyerowitz married, raised a family, and is now retired after a long career as a chiropractor. Of Arthur, he says, "He was my brother, my idol." In January 1968, Esther died, and Arthur, the dashing airman who had won her heart shortly before he was shipped to England in 1943, followed her in March 1971. Their two children, Mark and Carol, have 3 and 2 children respectively. Arthur worked hard to support his family the best he could, fighting to make a good life for them. Always, he remembered how lucky he was to even have that opportunity. Shortly after the liberation of Toulouse from the Nazis in the fall of 1944, the body of Marcel Taillandier was exhumed from the shallow mass grave where the Gestapo had so ignominiously buried him. His grateful nation would reinter his remains beneath a graceful monument in Toulouse, the city he had loved and fought for so fiercely and so valiantly. Survived by his wife and 2 daughters, Taillandier would be posthumously made a Knight of the Legion of Honor and a Companion of the Liberation, and was awarded the Croix de Guerre with palm, France's highest military honor, the Military Medal, the Medal of the Resistance, and the U.S. Medal of Liberty. He is revered today as one of France's greatest World War II heroes and stands as a symbol of the resistance. Arthur Meyerowitz revered him not only as a benefactor, but as a friend. Richard Frank Wharton Cleaver returned to his unit after his escape with Arthur Meyerowitz and went on to cement his reputation as one of the RAF's finest and most courageous pilots of World War II. Having already earned the Distinguished Service Order, DSO, for his gallantry and devotion to duty during the invasion of Sicily in 1943, Cleaver was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross on October 3, 1944, for staying at the controls of his burning Halifax bomber in April 1944, near Cognac, France. His skill, courage, and devotion to duty of the highest order saved all but one of his crew that night. All except one made it back home to Great Britain. Like Arthur, Cleaver married his sweetheart Dorothy in 1946. He remained in the RAF after the war and became one of his nation's first jet test pilots. In 1953, Cleaver was killed in the crash of an experimental and highly unstable jet fighter. The accident was front-page news throughout the United Kingdom. The oldest of his 3 children was 4 years old at the time of his death. Gisèle Chauvin miraculously returned to L'Espard from the road of death, surviving torture and deprivation at 3 concentration camps in Germany: Schwerin, Ravensbrück, and Sachsenhausen, where she was liberated by Allied troops in 1945. She came back a virtual scarecrow to Pierre and their children, and never fully regained her strength. Her survival testified to her courage and her indomitable will to see her family again, and to see France a free nation. Her son Patrick, an infant at the time when Arthur ended up in the Chauvin home, remembers his mother as a heroine of the resistance. So too does France. Except for Sergeant Thomas McNamara and Sergeant William Dunham, the other crewmen of Harmful Lil Armful survived the conflict. The pilot, Second Lieutenant Philip J. Chase, was debriefed after his liberation from a German Stalag prison camp. His account of the day that his B-24 went down presents a matter-of-fact portrait of a steady pilot doing everything he could to keep his crippled bomber aloft and everything he could to make sure his entire crew had a chance to parachute from the plane. Harmful Lil Armful's top turret gunner and flight engineer knew differently. To his dying day, Arthur S. Meyerowitz never wavered in his certainty that Chase and his co-pilot had jumped first from the bomber and abandoned their crew. Nightmares of that horrible mission above occupied France tormented him for the rest of his life. Arthur wished he had told everything he knew in his debrief, and he carried the regret for not doing so to his grave. Some 40 years after his death, his grandson, Seth Meyerowitz, whom Arthur never had the chance to meet, uncovered the full, long-hidden saga and became Arthur's voice to tell the story. The End. This is Jonathan Todd Ross. We hope you have enjoyed this production of The Lost Airman by Seth Meyerowitz and Peter F. Stevens. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, classics, histories, and more, so look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.